And we have returned, and with me right now is Jamie Marich, PhD. Dr. Jamie Marich is the author of Trauma and the 12 Steps, a complete guide to enhancing recovery, and EMDR Made Simple, four approaches for using EMDR with every client. Marich travels the country training and offering retreats on topics related to trauma and addiction while maintaining a private practice with, is it PsychCare?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Incorporated, in Youngstown, Ohio. Marich specializes in the treatment of addictions and traumatic stress concerns, in addition to working with spiritual concerns through a multidimensional lens. Marich is an EMDRIA, we'll talk about what that is, approved consultant. Has earned several peer-reviewed publications on her work with EMDR and addictions, and won a research award in 2008 from EMDRI. Marich began her career in human services while serving as a humanitarian aid worker in Bosnia from 2000 to 2003. Wow, that's a long time in Bosnia.
Mm-hmm.
An accomplished singer-songwriter with several recordings to her credit, most recently Grace of a Woman. Marich also developed a community-based wellness practice called Dancing Mindfulness. And we're going to listen to a song from her CD, Grace of a Woman. And she has graciously donated a CD and her book to Take 12 Radio. Thank you very much, Jamie.
You're more than welcome. Thank you.
Dr. Jamie? Talk to Dr. Jamie here.
Oh, just call me Jamie. I'm just Jamie M. and the circles that count, right?
Yeah, right. Well, how are you enjoying the conference so far?
I'm really, really enjoying it. All conferences are great networking opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this one is no exception, and I've also had a chance to hear some people who have really been influential to me, you know, at least in reading their work coming up in the field. And so there's been a couple people here I haven't gotten to hear before. So
right.
It's been a nice experience.
Right. Well, good. Well, tell us, I mean, I just read this short bio. What is it that you do and specialize in before we talk about your musical talents and being really a recovery recording artist in your own right?
Well, what do I do professionally? I'm in recovery myself.
Mm-hmm.
From both addiction and a lot of issues connected to post-traumatic stress.
Sure.
And for me, at about 2 years sober, it became really clear that I had to address a lot of these post-traumatic stress issues in order to not only stay sober, but stay emotionally sober and stay well. And so as a result, I did a lot of work with trauma study as I became a mental health counselor as well as an addiction counselor. And I really saw the importance of addressing trauma and addiction together. So that's what a lot of my work has been about over the years, whether it is in practice or training others on how to sensitively combine trauma recovery with addiction recovery. Because my experience has been a lot of addiction recovery people don't necessarily want to hear about trauma, and a lot of trauma recovery people don't necessarily want to hear about addiction, especially don't want to hear about 12 steps. And so I'm kind of like a let's bring all the worlds together. I've done that in my practice. I've done that in my teaching. So that's what my professional life's about.
Well, first of all, on the trauma thing, when you say trauma, mm-hmm. give us some examples.
Certainly. A lot of people think PTSD or post-traumatic stress when they think trauma. But trauma, in its purest form, comes from the Greek word meaning wound. And really, when we're talking about trauma, a lot of things can qualify as a wound, whether it's physical, emotional, sexual, spiritual, financial abuse. It could be something like a natural disaster, or it can be something like growing up in an alcoholic home. You know, we don't often think of that as PTSD trauma,
right.
But it's definitely wounding.
Absolutely.
And if these wounds go unresolved, that's where the issue arises. And a lot of times trauma shows itself as PTSD, but a lot of times it shows up in other things, other diagnoses, other complicating conditions, and I would argue most people coming into recovery have some type of trauma that's gone unhealed.
So is the PTSD, would that be the outward manifestation of the trauma, like alcohol is the outward manifestation of an inward condition?
It can be.
Yeah.
You know, PTSD, generally we think of those as the life-threatening traumas,
mm-hmm.
like the natural disasters, the physical abuse situations, whatnot. It's really the symptoms that are the outward manifestations. But it's important to consider that a lot of conditions like depression or other anxieties really are the manifestations of a trauma. It's just not necessarily the life-threatening trauma that we've always thought of.
I had a well-known doctor on, a medical doctor and also a 12-stepper that mm-hmm. was on years ago, who said every case of alcoholism that he personally dealt mm-hmm. with, this is his personal experience, had some force of severe trauma in their background. And much of it came out of abuse, whether it was mm-hmm. verbal, physical, sexual. He said in almost every case.
Yes.
Blew my mind. And I identify with that myself. Yeah.
Sure. And another form of abuse I would add to that is spiritual abuse.
Absolutely.
That we don't consider. You know, a lot of people growing up in real abuse of spiritual systems, and then mm-hmm. they come to recovery and they're asked to, you know, have faith in a God of understanding. Yeah.
And their only understanding is the past.
Know, yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. So there's a lot of forms of abuse that manifest, and we really need to be sensitive to them, you know, for people coming in. And in my perspective, you know, I'm not negating that addiction's a disease. I mean, I agree with the 12-step perspective, but I think we have to realize that people are coming in with a lot of wounding, and you know, to be sensitive to that.
There's a lot of people coming into 12-step support group meetings mm-hmm. that are alcohol abusers, are mm-hmm. drug abusers, but they're not addicts or alcoholics. Mm-hmm. They're not of the hopeless variety. So they may need a different kind of help.
Mm-hmm. That's possible.
It might not be a real deep spiritual thing for them. Maybe they can stay sober just by coming to meetings and seeing a clinician once in a while or mm-hmm. reading something nice. But there's the folks that are really, 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 really sick that... It's so multifaceted. I mean, there's mm-hmm. so many things going on. So,
and so much of, you know, what my approach is about is we really do have to meet people on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah.
And a lot of traditional people get afraid, like, oh, you know, what will that promote terminal uniqueness? I'm like, not necessarily, not if you handle it, you know, correctly. You know, just like when people share their stories and meetings, everybody has a unique story.
Sure.
And to me, a lot of what trauma-sensitive approach is about is recognizing that unique story and mm-hmm. helping a person to heal by meeting them where they're at.
You know, the malady might be the same, the solution might even mm-hmm. be the same, but yeah, people are, I tell people that I work with all the time, you are unique.
Yes.
You are unique. Mm-hmm. We're not necessarily talking about what they're trying to keep you from, this mm-hmm. unique thing that can hurt you, but in a very real way, you know, God made you totally different than me,
mm-hmm.
and like every snowflake's different, right?
I mean, right.
The way we address people, the way we associate, you know, our emotional balance, everything's
yes.
different. Okay, now here at the conference, have you presented anything? Are you?
I did. I presented with Dan Griffin on the first day. We did a pre-conference workshop on Dan Griffin's the author of A Man's Way Through the 12 Steps,
right.
And we did a presentation called "Healing the Wounded Healers:
right.
Extending Trauma-Informed Care to a Traumatized Field," and it really was a retreat day for professionals more than anything. You know, we offered some education, but to me, one of the most effective characteristics of a clinician working with trauma is your ability to have addressed your own trauma, your ability to be honest about how trauma and wounding has affected you. And one thing Dan and I have both seen in the field is, you know, a lot of counselors, a lot of sponsors are running around not even realizing they've been traumatized.
Sure.
And as a result, are not able to really effectively address the trauma they see in people.
Right.
So we had a great, you know, a great group of people, I think, who largely were trauma aware. Some people were taken by surprise once we got a little deeper, especially at expanding the definition of trauma. Because a lot of people think trauma is PTSD, but it is so much more than that.
Yeah, I think of sexual abuse mm-hmm. or a huge car and semi-truck
right.
accident or something,
mm-hmm.
you know, when you're, because trauma's got that big...
And we think, you're right, we think yeah. of life-threatening, but
right.
something to keep in mind is it can be life-altering without necessarily being life-threatening.
Yeah, makes total sense.
And that idea of if it's been a life-altering experience that has shaken your emotional core, changed how you see the world, it's significant, and we need to address it.
You know what I find really interesting is, particularly, and all you 12-steppers out there, hold on to your hats when I say this, I'm already real unpopular, is that the two areas that get criticized the most from 12-step support meetings are the church
mm-hmm.
and the medical field
mm-hmm.
or treatment.
Sure.
And yet there are two best advocates.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm like, what are you guys doing? You're mm-hmm. you're shooting ourselves in the foot when you say things like what you're saying against these things. One of the complaints that is really invalid, I believe,
mm-hmm.
is, well, the people that are in those treatment facilities and the clinicians and so forth, they're not alcoholics or addicts, so they don't understand.
A lot of us are.
A lot Yes, and here at this conference where there are mm-hmm. so many people in the top area of their field who are in recovery themselves. Mm-hmm. So for those of you out there that are of that mind thought, think again. Mm-hmm. It's just like when we say we're not doctors, we're not lawyers in 12-step meetings. Some of us are.
Right. And I do work with a lot of my colleagues who aren't alcoholics or addicts and don't understand. Sure. And I encourage them, if you have a question, come and talk to me. You know, I'd be happy to give you some of my feedback from the addicts or, you know, the alcoholic. And I'm a recovering codependent as well from our perspective. So, a lot of us are. And thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah, you bet. Okay. So you wear a different hat, too.
And one, I do.
It sounds like a lot of fun, a lot of work.
Yes.
I know that. These things aren't cheap to make.
Right.
And you put a lot of love and passion into this thing. Tell us about how you got into music.
Grace of Woman. Well, I've played music since a very young age. I was put into violin lessons when I was 3, you know, danced from a very young age. So the arts and performing have always been a part of my life. Like a lot of people, I kind of let it go during my active addiction, you know, especially in my college years. And then in recovery, I learned how to pick up a guitar, and I learned how to play guitar, even though I had been a violin player all my life. It was a good instrument because it allowed me to really sing while I did it, and I'd always enjoyed singing. So I did a lot of my early figuring out my traumas by songwriting. And it's been nothing I've ever chosen to pursue professionally, but I've gotten a lot of gigs. I play with a local guy where I'm from in Youngstown, Ohio, and we play in church and some coffee houses. And it's more or less an outlet for me than anything I've ever pursued professionally. And I encourage my clients to do it too. I'm like, even if you're not a songwriter, you know, put playlists together, find the music that enriches you and inspires you, because there's something so healing about music. And
right.
Yeah, the CD we're working with, Grace of a Woman. And I just, got a bunch of my friends to help me with the music. It's kind of been many years in the making because I've written a lot of that music as a response to some of my own healing themes that have come up in my life. And I just wanted to share it with people.
Now I want to comment on the cover.
Oh, certainly.
Because so many artists there's something going on mm-hmm. in the cover, and no radio person wants to talk about that. Well, I'm a graphic artist. I have an
Brilliant.
Artistic background and so forth. And I noticed there's a lot of going on in here. What is happening with this cover?
It's a collage, if you could see in the
yep.
back. I love making collages. I'm not really an artist, so it's the one visual thing I do like to do is mm-hmm. make collages. And I've often described my musical styles, my professional life, as a collage, because there's so many different genres I like. You know, you'll hear so many different genres on the album. There's a lot of different artistic modes of expression. Even within my professional life, I'm not one of those people who pigeonholes myself into one approach. I like mm-hmm. to hear from different people and different perspectives. So if you look really deeply at that collage, a lot of them are stickers or, you know, travel marks from places that were significant in my life. And whenever I go on a trip, like a major trip, I love to make a collage with just scraps that I've collected. They're one of my favorite art forms.
This is great. I really like this. This is awesome.
Thanks.
Well, we're going to listen to this song. I think I'll let you. It's this track 2 on her CD, Grace of a Woman. And I'll be looking forward to hearing her songs on our station as well. Tell us about I Think I'll Let You.
Well, as the first 3 steps were described to me, it's all about God can, I think I'll let him.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard that within my first year of recovery, and it really resonated because I needed the steps broken down in even simpler terms.
Sure. Sure.
And I actually wrote that song probably because I got sober in 2002, so I probably wrote that song within the first year of my recovery. And I performed it in a variety of different ways with my musical folk partner, just like to kind of sing it to myself. And then the version you're going to hear from the album, we ended up doing it real pop a cappella style. It just seemed to be the best forum to convey the message. So it's my 1-2-3-step song.
All right, here we go. Jamie, let's see if I say this right again. How do you pronounce it? Tell
Marich.
Me. Marich. Okay, mm-hmm. I almost said it wrong. Marich. Jamie Marich from her CD, Grace of a Woman. Here is I Think I'll Let You.
I'm standing at the door of something wonderful and free. Through the window pane. pain I looked at, love and joy awaiting. But I'm standing in destruction, misery consumes me. On my own I tried to ease my pain, and there I'd stand. But you can. I think I'll let you open up this door for me to freedom abounding. I can't, but you can. I think I'll let you open up this door for me to love and joy awaiting with happiness and peace. I searched and I tried everything I thought would fill this lonely gaping hole inside, but in the dark I stand.
This CD, how can people get your CD?
A couple ways. It's on iTunes.
Okay.
If you go on one of my websites, let me share the link, www.trauma12twelve.com. I have some links there on where to get all my materials, my books, my music. I believe it's also listed on Sunlight of the Spirit Music and with CD Baby.
Great, great. Awesome. Like I said, be looking forward to hearing more of Jamie's music. Okay, this book that you've written, Trauma and the 12 Steps, A Complete Guide to Enhancing Recovery. Tell us about this.
I wrote this book because when I did professional trainings, I got the feedback, you know, Jamie, it's good to hear that you're not anti-12 steps, because so many people who talk about trauma seem to be down on the 12 steps. And I'm like, that's interesting, because I think we need to see that there's still so much that the 12 steps can offer, you know, even for trauma survivors or complicated cases. But there are some things that counselors and sponsors need to take into consideration. For example, some of the slogans could be really shaming if delivered out of context to people who are still really raw and have been traumatized.
Some of the slogans really aren't a part of the 12-step program.
Exactly.
Either.
Exactly. Yeah. Like one of the slogans I get into in there is the good old take the cotton out of your ears, put it in your mouth.
I hate that.
And it's one of those, you know, the intention is good that you need to listen.
Right.
But the way it's delivered can be so abusive, especially if a person grew up in a home feeling like what I have to say is not important. Or if there was some kind of physical restraint involved as part of the trauma, it can be more re-traumatizing to hear such a slogan. Another one I kind of, you know, talk about is I'm not against the slogan one day at a time, because I think it's a great goal for people to work towards. But trauma by its nature, by the way it rests in the brain, keeps a person stuck in the past. So instead of just delivering it as an instant solution, you know, live one day at a time.
Yeah, what's wrong with you?
One thing I talk about is we have to help people to learn how to live one day at a time.
Yeah.
And a lot of that will include helping them work through some of the trauma barriers.
Well, there's another school of thought that wasn't a part of the original Alcoholics, the mothership, the Alcoholics Anonymous program. In fact, they said we had to be willing to quit for good and for all.
Mm-hmm.
And people say, well, I just stopped drinking today. And they've been in there for 15 years. It's like, no, you live out your day one day at a time.
Right.
But as far as this goes, you're done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's not even really a part of the original thing. A lot of people don't like, that's why I say I'm unpopular already. But,
right.
But you're right. With somebody that's, because we are multifaceted, we got people that have all sorts of issues coming in. And what if they can't handle the past?
Mm-hmm.
What if they can't escape from that and just live in today? What are you going to do? Just send them away?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah,
so I cover a lot of those issues in there, and I am not anti-12-step by any means, but I do call out, you know, a lot of meetings in there, because I, you know, I'm a big believer not all meetings are created equally. Some are very good.
Yeah, some people say, I've never been to a bad meeting. I have.
Oh, yeah. Some I would never send a patient to, you know, just because I think they might be walking into a really unhealthy trap. So there's a lot of practical guides in there on how to help, you know, especially sponsors who aren't in recovery, how to help them work with people who are in recovery, figuring out which meetings might be good, which sponsors might be a good fit for people.
You really do have to look at it on an individual basis.
Absolutely.
You really do. It's not a blanket thing.
Right.
It can't be. Wow, great. Well, I'm going to be delving into this book, Trauma and the 12 Steps, A Complete Guide to Enhancing Recovery. And this is so much about trauma. So many of us have been through a trauma. And now, this doesn't sound like a big deal to so many people, but I was adopted. With that comes all sorts of stuff.
Yes.
From what the worldly clamor says about it.
Yes.
To things I remember that are still vivid in my mind as a two-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
I remember being burned with cigarette butts in a foster home. I remember a really nice lady giving me carrots.
Yes.
And she was wonderful. And then my adoptive parents came, and the social worker came to visit one day, and I was playing on the floor, and she says, oh my gosh, she said, he's never done that before. That means he feels real comfortable here. You know, I remember her. Isn't that amazing?
It is. Yeah. And I think it shows that positive or memory or negative, the memory is a positive thing. And it really is those things that happen before the age of 8 that seem to be most formative, you know, either good or bad.
Yeah.
So, thank you for sharing that
Thank you,
me.
Jamie, so much for sharing your time with us.
It's my pleasure.
It's been wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Stay in touch.
Okay. Stick around. We got to get a picture real quick for the website. All right, folks. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, more from the Evolution of Addiction Treatment Conference in Los Angeles. We'll be right back.
Hey, Justin, Sarah.
Hi, Ricky.
Hi.
Hey, listen, I just heard about some kids who might try to get some beer.
So, why are you telling us?
Yeah.
Well, because I thought maybe we could go and, you know, drink.
Why?
Because it's cool.
Cool? Why is it cool?
Well, you know, we can go and get wasted.
And why would we want to get wasted?
Well, remember that time when we heard some older kids talking about doing it?
So, why should we do it?
Well, I guess I don't know.
Sooner or later, someone may ask you if you want to drink. If that ever happens to you, maybe there's something you should ask them. Like why? Because the fact is, most kids don't drink. Even older kids. So think about it. There's no good reason to drink. Want to know more? Check out thecoolspot.org.
Okay, welcome back, friends and family. We're here at the conference once again with you. Sitting across from me, and he's getting all sorts of people coming up to him. He's got groupies everywhere.
Great. Go dance.
We got this guy. I got to tell you, listeners, you wonder what this guy was like when he was partying. He was just like this, right? This is Dan Griffin. He is the author of your book,
A Man's Way Through the 12 Steps, published by Hazelden, and Helping Men Recover, which is a curriculum that is published by Wiley and Sons Publishing.
Right on. And because there is a difference between women working the 12 steps and men working the 12 steps.
Absolutely. And the interesting thing has been that because the 12 steps were created by men, there really wasn't a lot of focus on men.
Right.
And then with women, women said, well, this really doesn't work for us. So now what we're at is probably maybe the, at least the next evolution, if not the final evolution, which is really to say, okay, so women need something that really speaks to their unique experience, but men need something that speaks to our unique experience mm-hmm. as well, not just some generic kind of created by men thing, but something that was consciously created saying, what's men's common experience, and then how do we best support men in getting sober as a result of that?
You know, people talk about in 12-step fellowships about you know, sponsors working with same-sex sponsees, and it always comes up because of the sexual thing. And I've always thought there's a whole other element to this. Women's brains operate differently than men's. So if you're a man and you've got a female sponsor, you're not thinking on the same kind of plane, or vice versa.
There is definitely something to that. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things in the work that I've done, this is how I explain it to people, is that, you know, there's been a lot of emphasis on the differences between men and women. But when men and women, it's kind of like this, and if I'm showing it visually, so I can't really, but it's like you have men on this far end and women on this far on the other end of the continuum.
Yeah.
And we meet each other there. But then as we start moving in recovery and moving toward authenticity, we become much more similar. And so the reality is that with men and women, I think there is a core kind of masculinity and a core kind of femininity.
Yeah.
And so I think there's some real value to what you're saying. I think the challenge is that if you have men who are so reinforced in thinking stereotypically as men and don't push themselves outside of some of those boundaries, mm-hmm. then they're going to have happen what we experience a lot of the times with men in recovery or vice versa with women in recovery, and that is they stay stuck in those rules that they grew up with about how they feel they have to live, the ideas that they think make them men or make them women, mm-hmm. and they get in the way of their recovery. Mm-hmm. Being in recovery for 18 years now, I've watched those men who have embraced certain parts of the program. They've even maybe even embraced in some ways the whole program, but yet they still have such a hard time connecting to people. Such a hard time admitting when they're hurt, such a hard time really sharing their feelings, such a hard time being something other than their job, because those things are so deeply rooted inside of us that we tend to think that that's how men are. I don't believe that. I don't believe mm-hmm. that's how men are. I believe that's a strong part of how we were raised. And then I think there's some real differences. I do think there's some differences. I mean, men tend to be more action-oriented. Men tend to be, you know, my wife and I, we discipline our daughter differently. We balance each other. You know, she's much right. more into the love and compassion and taking care, and I'm into the accountability and the discipline and setting limits. But at the same time, with my wife, I'm the one who is very emotional at, like, watching TV or watching a movie, and she's a little more reserved. She's a little more the one who's thinking things through, and I'm the one who's not. So it's
oh man.
So at the essence of it, and really now that we've got people talking about men's recovery and women's recovery, the essence of it, what's so cool is that it's really about saying, who are you?
Mm-hmm.
Like, who are you, Monty? Who are you, Dan? Well, Dan is a guy who loves tennis, who cries when he watches sad movies, who is big on integrity and accountability, has a loud voice, is hyper, you know, is very caring and sincere, and, you know, wears pink. Who cares?
Yeah.
Like, that's who I am.
Right.
So when who you are transcends being a man or a woman, that's when I think we're on the right path.
Yeah, very cool, very cool. Let's talk about five ways to improve men's treatment.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is something I just recently came up with because I go around and I talk to people all over the country, or when I introduce myself to people and it's like, what do you do? And I say, well, you know, I work with treatment programs on how to enhance their men's services. And they're like, yeah, okay, great, what's wrong with men's services? And it's not that there's anything wrong with men's services, but those services have been created in a paradigm that wasn't consciously thinking about men's needs. So those five pieces that I came up with, and in some ways they're arbitrary. There's probably 25, right?
Sure.
But these five are significant. One is talking about how men's socialization needs to be the context. The other is this idea of safety first, and with safety, this idea of trauma, and talking about trauma. An interesting kind of logistical piece of small groups, and then sex, and talking about sex, and then, interestingly, homophobia. And when we say homophobia, and I'll start with that one, talking briefly about that. When we say homophobia, we mean more, less about homosexuality. We mean more about homo, man, phobia, right. Fear. Fear of men, fear of closeness with men, fear of relationships with men. In fact, core to my work is the belief that homophobia is one of the greatest impediments to men's recovery.
I agree with you.
Thank you.
Well, I agree with you.
I think a lot of men get it, but it's having the courage to say it.
Yeah.
And having the courage to step outside of it. I mean, I can be a real goofball, as you saw last night. But when it comes to being very serious about recovery, you know, for me, there's lines, and there's lines that need to be drawn, and there's lines that need to be undrawn.
You bet, you bet. And I think you're right. I think there's that stigma. You say homophobia, a person says, well, they're either, yeah, that's right, I am, or you know, they put up a wall. No, I'm not that way.
Right.
And they don't really understand what you're saying. We're not talking about...
It's got nothing to do with sex.
No, it's just because somebody is living in this kind of lifestyle and you don't like it and it's making you paranoid, that doesn't necessarily mean you're homophobic. I mean, but somebody could be homophobic and have nothing to do with that.
Right.
You're right. And then what people don't understand is that word means man. You know, just, and there are people in 12-step fellowship today and other kinds of recovery treatment, when it comes to being intimate with another man on a deep spiritual personal level, they are scared to death.
And that's exactly what I mean when I say, so if you have a man sponsoring a man, and that man who's sponsoring him has still bought into some of that BS, has still bought into some of those rules, then he's going to hold his own sponsee at a distance.
You're right.
He's going to perpetuate some of the same stuff where that sponsee might need him literally. I mean, I've held guys that I've worked with as they cried talking about the porn that's destroying their life at 7 years of sobriety.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the thing for me is, you know, I just... There's so much opportunity for growth. Let's just put it that way. But the most important thing is that those of us who believe that men are more than the rules that we've been told to follow just need to be vocal about it, need to be courageous about it, and need to be adamant about it and say, you know, like, look, you know, yeah, it's okay to joke and everything, but no, it's not okay to make fun of another man because of his sexual orientation or to exclude him from meetings or to joke around with guys in a men's meeting, assuming that everybody there is straight, when you could be alienating somebody for any number of reasons. So that's the homophobia, but it's also, like you said, it's in the touch, just hugging, hugging man. Look at how men hug each other.
Yeah.
You know, they burp the baby. Yeah. That's what I call it. They call it burping the baby, right? So that's one of them.
I am a big promoter of hugs because there's actually a chemical that's released.
Absolutely,
when it happens, and women can die without it. You know, the
chemical, what is it? Oxytocin?
Something like that.
Yeah.
If they don't get some women can, but I think it's absolutely essential. And when a man breaks through that barrier of, well, I'm not supposed to get close with, you know, when he breaks through it, it is so awesome. And then they start to open up and cry. A buddy of mine sat in the meeting here not too long ago and said, I'm an alcoholic. And then he started to weep. He'd been in there for years and he couldn't say it.
Wow.
And then he became vulnerable and very close with people. And I was thinking, well, he wasn't very touchy-feely, but now he's just shaking everybody's hand and hugging everybody. That's just awesome.
That's right. He got broken open.
Broken open.
Right? You know, it's like a friend of mine used to say, I said, this feels so hard. It feels like my heart is breaking. And she said, yes, it is. It's breaking open. And I love that. So I'll just cover the other four really quick.
Yeah.
This idea of men's socialization should be the context. I'll just give you a quick example of what does that mean. Well, you know, think about these rules I've been talking about, the rules for being a man. Be strong. Don't cry. Don't be vulnerable. Don't show your emotions. Don't ask for help. Be powerful. Be the sexual aggressor. Don't show you care too much about relationships. Does that sound familiar? Be the protector. Be the provider.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Integrity, discipline. But a lot of them tend to be don'ts and negative. So you got these rules that men are living by, and then you have men come into a treatment program, and what are they told? Share your feelings.
Yeah.
Be vulnerable.
All that stuff that you're
cry.
Not supposed to.
Cry. Oh, man. Ask for help. You're powerless. You know, essentially the opposite of how we spent our whole lives. And why this is important, and this is what's so critical when it comes to saying to do things differently for men. The reason why this is so critical is because... So then what does that mean when a man is struggling? It means a man is struggling because he should be. He should be struggling.
Yeah.
So we don't have enough compassion for men in the struggle. We don't own the fact that we're asking them to turn their identity on who they are. We don't. There's a lot of stuff that we don't do because we don't recognize what we're asking men to do. And those of us who work in the field who are still kicking and screaming our way through the process... existentially, you know, like internally, mm-hmm. we pretend like it's easy. And so we say these guys are non-compliant, disengaged, they're any number of things, as opposed to, hey, what's going on? And when you give men the language of the rules, mm-hmm. they can talk to you in a way that men can't normally talk to you. If you say, hey, man, what's going on? I don't know. Okay, well, let's look at these rules. Tell me, which are the rules that are getting in the way for you? All of a sudden, it opens up a conversation that was never really that easy to get before for man. We can take, I know this sounds like an infomercial, we can take the toughest, most broken down, most uncommunicative men, and we can get them to open up because we use this process and some of these other things in a way that, I mean, we are amazed by with the programs that we've been using this with.
Man, it sounds... one side of it sounds like a whole heck of a lot of work. The other side of it sounds like a whole heck of a lot of freedom.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. The only work is working against the natural inclination to
right.
be who we are.
The other stuff is actually
so.
Not that
so
hard.
When we say recovery is a process of letting go, mm-hmm. that's really what we're letting go of. Letting go of all these bullshit rules, excuse me, all these rules, right? Can I, all
yeah,
these BS,
yeah, we're fine.
All these BS rules.
Yeah.
That are killing men. They're killing men. Men get sober, but they're losing their marriages. They're ending up in domestic violence programs. They're still doing all kinds of stupid shit because they don't know how to break out of the rules. They still got this rule that says, you know what? I am feeling really insecure about my marriage, but I can't talk about it. So I'm just going to laugh with the other men in the meeting. I really feel hurt by what my wife did to me the other night, but I'm going to be grumpy and go in the basement, or I'm going to be angry at her, and then I'm going to do one more thing to tear into the fabric of the love that we have for each other, and then I'm going to go around talking about what a bee she is.
Right.
Because it's got nothing to do with me, because I'm 10 years sober, and I blah, 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 big book, blah, blah, blah. This for me, this is about life and death. It's about having a truly free life. Because there are so many men who are walking around in recovery still imprisoned. And I'm not going to say I'm completely free by any means. I see this stuff and I understand it more than I can live it. But I'm living it more than I ever
right.
have.
Right.
And so that's what's, you know, and that's, I think, what leads to the next piece of safety. Safety is so incredibly important because if men don't feel safe, they're not going to let that part of themselves out. And the thing about it is that we tend to make assumptions about men's safety because men are not going to tell you they don't feel safe.
Right? People just automatically assume that because
it's not
a
big
guy,
deal. Yeah, yeah, it's not that big of a deal.
Yeah.
So what we say, we turn the whole thing on its head. We say anytime a man is coming into his first meeting, anytime a man is coming into treatment, your assumption should be that he doesn't feel safe. And then you want to interact with him and interpret his behavior as if that's a man who doesn't feel safe. So when he's acting cocky, it's because he doesn't feel safe. When he's acting arrogant, it's because he doesn't feel safe. Cocky, arrogant, is acting like obnoxious, apathetic, sarcastic, you know, immature.
Mm-hmm.
All of it is a sign of him not feeling safe rather than not caring.
Or shutting down and not even talking.
Or shutting down is about safety. So when you think about it, safety, you treat men differently. You look at them differently.
Yeah.
You know, so that's a piece.
Yeah, because we must assume when somebody walks in
the
door.
We always assume.
That we must say, this is a fragile person. We
have to start thinking about it for men. Even the fully tattooed 6'4" guy who's just, his muscles are just bulging out of him. You know, you got to be able to look at him and say, I'm going to guess that he doesn't feel safe right now. You know, and because we don't know what kind of trauma these guys are walking around with. We don't know what they're carrying.
Right.
And that's the biggest thing. So that's another reason why we do these small groups. That's number 3 of the 5.
Uh-huh.
Because, again, you want men to open up? Put men in groups of 3. You can have a therapeutic group, and you can have 6 people or 9 people, and that's a small group. Put them into groups of 3, and you will get men who used to never participate or who didn't seem to have a lot to say suddenly can't stop talking. And it's just because you're putting them in such a small group that you can't really hide. Men don't really want to hide. The reality is, and so this group of 3, you know, if you put them in 2, it can become still a little too easily buddy-buddy, right?
Right, and then they never get to the issue.
You don't necessarily get to the issues, but with 3... it doesn't seem to be near the issue.
Wow, that's good. That's really good.
So, you know, that's just one of the little tricks that we found.
And with a room full of 12 people, now I got to figure out how I'm going to trust every single one of them.
Yeah.
When it comes my time to share.
Yeah.
And that's not going to happen.
Exactly. Yeah. So when you have them breaking in groups of 3, as you know.
That is good. Good, good, good stuff.
And then the last thing is sex. And let's talk about sex, but not just let's talk about sex. Let's be honest about men's sexuality. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about how scared men are to have sex sober. Let's talk about how clueless men are about their bodies, about women's bodies, and about having sex. Let's talk about sexual abuse. Let's talk about porn and the use of porn. The use of porn in men in treatment and the use of porn in men working in treatment. Let's talk about homophobia. Let's talk about masturbation. Let's talk about healthy sexuality. Let's talk about love and intimacy. Let's talk about every damn part of a man's sexuality so that men leave feeling competent and capable to have relationships in sobriety.
Wow. And that's got to be a big, big, big one, right?
I mean, it's huge.
If you can break through that, you can break through anything,
huge.
Right?
It's absolutely huge.
Yeah. Wow. All right, Dan Griffin is our guest right now. I love the saying at the end of this page you gave me, because we cannot just change what men think, we have to change what we think about men. That
Amen.
Is awesome. And it's dangriffin.com is the
it's
website?
It's Dan Griffin, GRIFFIN.com. And,
right,
and it's Dan at dangriffin.com if you want to just say hi.
And if you want to party with him, come to a conference and sit at his table.
Thanks so much, man.
Right on, buddy. Thank you. All right, folks, we'll be back in just a minute.
Introducing CHANCE, Community Helping Addicts Negotiate Change Effectively. The mission of CHANCE is to assist individuals within our community who have substance abuse-related issues and who are seeking recovery to effectively implement positive change. CHANCE provides support, guidance, and the necessary resources to facilitate development of life skills. CHANCE is one of the most effective programs helping our community recover from the power of drug and alcohol addiction. But for CHANCE to continue, we need your financial support. Won't you consider a donation? Make a check or money order out to CHANCE, P.O. Box 1256, Albany, Oregon. That's CHANCE, P.O. Box 1256, Albany, Oregon. CHANCE, offering recovery support services for the people of Linn County, Oregon.
County, Oregon.
Okay, we have returned. Let's see here. I'm messing with my sound equipment because my headphones are playing games with me. All right. Welcome back to the Evolution of Addiction Treatment Conference 2013 here at the Westin LAX Hotel and Convention Center. The gentleman sitting across from me right now is none other than Dr. Alan Berger, Mr. Emotional Sobriety. You are a character.
Thanks, Marty. You are too, man. Let's before you go any further, let me say to all your listenership, what a treat it is to have you here. Monty went to great lengths to come down here. It was, I'm sure, a challenge, and I just want, on behalf of the Evolution Conference, we love you, and we're glad you're here.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. And the work that you do is invaluable. Really quickly, tell us a little bit about, for those who people that never heard of you, which I can't imagine, but for those of you out there that haven't,
well, I'll give a brief synopsis of my career. So 41 years ago, I came into this field.
Right.
And right after Vietnam, I'm a Vietnam vet, and I got some help. And I just got so turned on to recovery, to helping people, and to learning. And I went back to school, became a clinical psychologist. And so for my whole entire professional career, I've been working with people in recovery. And I love it, Monty. I love people in recovery want to grow. They want to learn. Mm-hmm. They want to discover new possibilities in their life. So it's, I feel like it's been such a privilege. So along the way, I've had a lot of great teachers and experience, and I decided to share that knowledge in some books. So I wrote 12 Stupid Things That Mess Up Recovery,
right,
which has been very popular. Yep. You know, it's being used all across the nation for people in recovery to learn more about their recovery and to avoid some of the pitfalls that can happen. I wrote the second book that you and I have talked about, 12 mm-hmm. Smart Things to Do
right.
When the Booze and Drugs Are Gone, on emotional sobriety. And that's what I've been focusing on lately, is really helping people understand that concept and how they can start plugging in some ideas to achieve emotional sobriety in their recovery. And in a couple months, which I hope to return on your show to talk about, I've got a book coming out called 12 Hidden Rewards of Making Amends. And it's on working steps 8, 9, and 10, which are the steps that really create emotional sobriety, aren't they?
Yes, and you know, I'm glad you said that, because one of the things that I have a real bugaboo about is...
Only one, but your wife is here, so I'm going to find out afterwards how many other bugaboos you got. And I'll bet you it's more than one. Is it more than one? Yeah, she's even said, we're going to get her on the mic. I'm going to interview her. And now they're going to hear a whole other story here, all right? Oh, you got one.
Yeah, I'll push the mic away from you, but don't move your seat.
There you go.
Good.
Okay.
That's perfect.
I just speak so loud.
I know, you've got a passion, brother.
Yes.
Okay.
I knocked him off balance.
Yeah, I'm okay.
Your wife's enjoying the heck out of this.
I'm back.
All right.
The promises. Oh, I hate that. It should say the ninth step promises.
Yes,
take
it
them
should.
Off the wall if it doesn't say the ninth step promises.
Right.
Because people are going, they're on their third step. They're on their second step. Yeah. Why haven't I got any of the promises?
That's right.
Well, you haven't made any financial amends. You're not financially free
yet.
You know, these things, it says, if we are painstaking about this, this place in our recovery.
Well, then you're going to love what I say in this book, because it really is. Those promises are a result of a lot of hard work we do.
Right.
By the time we get to step eight, to get ready for step eight takes a lot of work.
Yeah.
We got to do a lot of work on ourselves. And then to do step eight and really do it, you got to have a lot of courage. And when you do that, then you got to do the next step, which even takes more courage, facing people, right?
Yeah.
And then you got to keep doing that in your life, and that's what it's all about. Now, listen, I'm on a tight schedule. I'm going to be going and giving a talk about second stage recovery for men.
Good for
but
you.
I'll be back. We'll be back together, and I want to say personally to you, thank you for coming.
Oh, bless you, my brother. Thank
and I'm
you.
So glad your wife is here to see you in action.
So much. All right.
All right, buddy.
This is take12radio.com. Our email address is take12radio@comcast.net. And our web address is take12radio.com on your internet dial. All right, with me right now is Hank Estrada. And the reason I've asked Hank to come over and share what's going on with him is because I was really intrigued by his website. I'm not sure how I came across it here about a month ago, entitled Unholy Communion. Now, many of you know, most of you know that listen to the show, that I was in ministry. I was an associate pastor and a youth minister for a number of years. And at the pinnacle of that, I was in my active addiction. And it was not something that brought forth inappropriate behavior on my part, except that I was too snockered to lead worship, and that didn't go over real great. But it could have been something a lot more devastating. And the reason that I'm picking on Hank right now is because I'm absolutely convinced that the more and more I learn about addiction and alcoholism and compulsivities and so forth, the more and more I'm convinced that there is some form of trauma, particularly sexual abuse, behind many, many, many of us who are in recovery. So, Hank Estrada, welcome to Tazewell Radio.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Okay, you're at this conference. Have you done any presentations here?
Not at this point, no.
Okay. But you've done it before.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay, so what's going on with this website? What's this all about?
This website basically addresses specifically adult male survivors of sexual abuse, whether it happened as a child, in most cases that those are the audiences that I encounter,
right.
But also more recently adult men who are sexually victimized. The problem is just getting larger and larger when you're dealing with the clergy abuse survivors. Now we're talking about military abuse survivors who getting assaulted by fellow military people. These are issues that have been around for a long time, but are just because more people are speaking about it or now being able to address it.
So you're talking about a group of men coming in and raping a new recruit or something like that?
Correct.
I mean,
correct.
Happens way more than we know,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're just scratching the surface on that.
Wow.
But my website addresses my own personal experience of being assaulted as a child at the age of 5 to the age of 15 by an uncle.
Mm.
And it was the family's favorite uncle who babysat all of the other uncles and aunts' children.
Mm-hmm.
So once I came forward with my report and accusation, it split the family, as you can imagine.
Oh,
in
sure.
Most cases, it does. Some believe you and some don't believe you. Some accept it, some don't accept it. The same thing happening today with the Catholic Church in particular,
mm-hmm.
Where some authorities in the church believe you and some don't, and they deny and they continue to push it. So the dynamics are very similar there for men in particular, that whether to tell or to not tell, are you going to be believed or are you going to be laughed at? That internalizes a lot of struggle for men.
Do you think that there is a large number of people saying they don't believe, that are really in denial, and they do know
absolutely
that something's going on? Yeah.
Absolutely. There are also many survivors who deny it and turn to substance abuse, alcohol, drugs, sexual acting out, sexual compulsion. There's all kinds of ramifications and different types of addictions that come from being victimized and not addressing it.
I have a theory.
Okay.
And I don't have a whole lot to base this on. It's just an idea that I
sure
had. The Bible talks about if a person is the kind of person that can handle celibacy, that it would be better to do that and dedicate your whole life to God than to marry. If you are somebody with the gift that can actually handle that, I'm thinking, if you take a whole bunch of men that, you know, their intentions are good, they want to serve in ministry in some form or another, and particularly in the Catholic Church, if there's celibacy required, but they're not, they don't even know, and they can't handle that, forced celibacy, to me, could bring all sorts of issues up. Alcoholism, smoking, sexual abuse. Am I any way in the ballpark?
You are to a certain extent. Now, here, let me add on to that, where it's very similar to serving in the military. You have men off on their own, living among each other. They're under stress, and having to deal with that kind of environment is pretty much, it can lead to a lot of difficulties with issues around sexuality and relationships and interpersonal.
Mm-hmm.
And you throw on top of that addictions, alcoholism, drug addiction, and it's pretty interesting the dynamics, how that works between trying to live celibate lives and not accomplishing it, and the guilt that comes with that, from a religious organization, and it's not just the Catholics. It's, although that's what they're known for. The priests are supposed to be celibate, and so they get all the media attention.
They get all the media attention.
But believe
me,
I've encountered different types and levels of religious organizations who have their issues.
Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
With sexual assaults and abuse.
Yeah, yeah. We just had a thing happen here recently in our particular body where a young man, a minor, had assaulted another minor, and it crushed people. I mean, the church didn't split or anything. People were very supportive. But this young man, the life he has now ahead of him, and the victims' lives they have ahead of them is going to be a challenge and a half, you know.
Now, what that brings to mind for me is there's always two sides to an issue.
Yes.
And we don't know what happened to that
to
young
him.
Man.
That's right.
We don't know what his history is. We don't know what his experiences is, because not all men who were sexually assaulted as children go on to perpetrate. That's
right.
Really, really important.
Right. Right.
If anything, we become social workers, we become counselors, protectors of children, et cetera, et cetera. So that is one of the myths that we still have to fight. But when you hear about something like that happening, all of a sudden you tend to focus on the victims and the perpetrator. But what about and someone that young, mm-hmm. like you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
what drew him to that, you know?
Right, right, exactly.
We don't know, but
so Hank, what happened to you?
With me?
Yeah,
it was I was sexually assaulted. Like I said, was as a child by an uncle.
Right, the uncle, was he in ministry or
he was not in ministry?
Okay.
And fortunately, I got to a point at 16 where it was unbearably difficult because my father was a violent alcoholic, former Marine. So, and I,
wow.
being his oldest child, mm-hmm. I took the brunt of a lot of his acting out and abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, his brother living with us was sexually assaulting me. So at 16, I attempted suicide. And I thought
wow.
that was the only way to get over this. Fortunately, I didn't succeed.
Yeah, right.
And
on.
What happened was I went to therapy. I found a therapist, got counseling, was able to talk about it and deal with it and realize that it was not my responsibility or choice. I didn't choose.
Yeah.
It didn't happen. It wasn't my fault, basically,
right.
is what came from that.
There's a reason why... there's this whole minor issue, that children, I mean, the brain isn't even completely developed till like 25 or something like that. So you've got a 14-year-old or a 6-year-old or even a 17-year-old who cannot make the decisions that are required to make to condone this kind of behavior. And so somebody comes along that does have, you know, an adult comes in there, they're influenced by them, this happens, and then when they get older, it's all about, this was me, this was my fault, this is, how could I let this happen?
Correct.
But we need to let people know that, hey, buddy, your brain wasn't even developed yet.
That's right.
Right?
And you carry some of that experience onto adulthood. Now, for me, I had a double whammy, I say, in that after the getting over the sexual assault as a child, in college, I encountered a predator priest, a Catholic priest who sexually assaulted me as a young college student. So I had the first experience, then the second experience.
Right.
And the dynamics of that are all in my book, Unholy Communion. But that was a whole another experience with dealing with a predator who knew what he was doing to manipulate someone to respond in the way he wanted.
Well, let me ask you this. Somebody listening right now that doesn't understand might be saying, well, you were in college for crying out loud. I mean, you've heard this before, right?
Absolutely.
You were
all
in
the
college,
time.
Right? You could have made a decision right now and said, you know, no, this is not. So what's the story behind that?
The story behind that is because of what happened as a child and what the mentality and the vulnerability that we all have. Various buttons get pushed. And
right.
as addicts, former addicts, addiction, anything can set us off. And not knowing what those are in an early adulthood can lead you vulnerable to being reassaulted. And the assault in both cases was subtle. It wasn't forced. Mm-hmm. It was subtle. It was somebody I looked up to, both of them, uncle and the priest,
right.
Someone I respected, someone who said they loved me. So you got to keep that in mind, that it's not something that you freely give into, but you do have the power of one who's a leader over someone who's a follower.
Your graphics on your site, okay, it shows what could be interpreted as somebody in leadership in the Catholic Church. But I want because you've got the person in the robes,
correct,
with his back to you, and then you got the flames and Unholy Communion. Very powerful, very powerful. But I want the listeners to understand, you're not picking on any one group of people.
Not at all.
Okay, it's just that it sends a message that's very important, that we got people in leadership, people that are trusted, because that's not just a symbol of necessarily Catholicism.
That's right.
Not
at all.
Of authority.
It's just,
it's a symbol of leadership, of adulthood, and so forth. So I just want listeners to,
that's right, absolutely. It's my story, and it's a story of healing, recovery, and being able to move forward with life. That's the main point. The website is hankestrada.com.
Hankestrada.com,
yes.
And are you available to speak in the share at conferences?
I am, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely.
And they get in contact with you through your website?
Yes, definitely.
Hankestrada.com. Well, Hank, thank you so much.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Folks, make sure you go to the website. It's hankestrada.com. Unholy Communion is the book. And we'll be back in just a few minutes.
Nothing sweeter than the positive music found at take12radio.com on your internet dial.